Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guest, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, who has a lot of thoughts about Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party, destabilizing Russians, treasonous Americans, and what it means to be a progressive. If you're in New York or Washington or you're a political obsessive, you know who Terry McAuliffe is. He's Bill Clinton's best friend. He's so close to the Clintons that he had a pet chicken named Hillary. That chicken actually died right before the election and replaced it with Hillary Jr. He was the Democratic National Committee chair almost 20 years ago. He's probably the most successful political fundraiser in history. Anyone who's been around politics and everyone has a crazy Terry McAuliffe story. Him at a party, him grabbing you and just being super enthusiastic or saying something that he shouldn't have said or making a call and just pushing in every kind of nutty way. But over the course of reporting this, one of the things that I came across was the opposition research document that the Republicans put together at the beginning of 2013 when he was running for the second time for governor and ultimately won. And it points out in there that a lot of Republicans even love him, despite the fact that he drives them crazy. It was a limitations section, and it says that beware of all the pals that he has, his golfing buddies and ex-party chairs and all the Republicans who really like him, too. McAuliffe was in Virginia on election night. The plan was that he was going to fly to New York for Hillary Clinton's party, but that got scrapped when they could see where the results were going. Since then, he's leapt into working on fundraising for the Democrats' redistricting efforts, co-chairing the National Governors Association, having a run-in with Trump that he's quite proud of. He said to me, I looked him face-to-face, 4 inches from his eyeballs, and said, everything you have done has hurt my economy. And he's got a plan for next year. He's going to campaign all over the country for Democrats running for governor, which is something that Democrats are going to be eager to have in terms of the help and probably the fundraising help. It also might just be useful if he does indeed run for president in 2020, which is something that he's talking about. And it's maybe not that crazy as we talked about it. He's a popular swing state governor. He's got a business record, a knack for shooting his mouth off. Maybe he's the Bizarro Trump, a Democrat said to me. He didn't know who Bizarro is. He's not much of a Superman fan. But I didn't exactly say no to that. Bill Clinton, I've been told, is generally supportive of his running. But first, he's got to separate himself from Hillary Clinton because he doesn't want to be running her third presidential campaign. Listen to what he said to me when I asked him what he thought of Hillary speaking out. Listen to how he responded when I asked him why he didn't join the board of her new PAC and saying he'd never even heard what it was called before. Remember to subscribe and rate us, catch up on episodes, and coming soon, really cool interview with Jason Kander and more. Follow me on Facebook and on Twitter at Isaac Dover. And email me your thoughts at isaac@politico.com. And now, our conversation with Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. So you jumped out of an airplane. Why were you jumping out of an airplane?
Well, I had a big week last week. I not only jumped out of an airplane, the beginning of the week, I was the first governor to go up in an unmanned drone. So I actually flew a drone, no pilot, just a robot, and had the laptop with all the controls and clicked on takeoff. It took off, flew for 8 miles, land, and it actually landed. And then I finished the week by jumping out of a plane at 10,000 feet to land in a Wounded Warrior. We have a big event at Virginia Beach, concert, and to honor the Wounded Warriors, and the USO puts it on. And in fact, I'd been down there a year ago to open the concert up, and they said, well, you know, Governor, we invited you to parachute with the Wounded Warriors. I said, what? And never the EPU, my security, and the office collectively decided we're not going to tell him this because he's going to want to do it. Well, I said clearly, I promise you I will be here next year. So I added.
Did your security have to scout out, like jump out ahead of you to see?
Well, people get a little kick out of it, so they let me go up in an unmanned drone, and they let me jump out of a plane.
You're just living out every teenage boy's dream.
They just don't care. 7 months to go. Let them do what the guy wants to do. They're not, and they know pretty much. At the end of the day, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And it was pretty. But it was what a rush. And, you know, I was fine, but I'll be honest with you, got a little anxious moment when you literally got up to the 10,000 feet, and they opened the door, and I was to be the first one out.
But you were tethered to someone? Or you?
Yeah, you go out with a guy, and we had a couple Wounded Warriors with us. And you look out, so he's behind me, and then they say jump, and then they really don't, you don't jump, you get pushed.
Right.
And then off you go, you tumble out, and we free fall for a minute or two, and then they pull the chute, and then it's actually a very lovely ride down, and came right over the beach where all the folks were. It was a great experience.
So I would, I've always wanted to skydive, but my wife has told me that it is out of the question. Is it, were you frightened?
A little anxious. I was really jacked up, fired up. You meet, you know, we met with the Wounded Warriors before, and you know.
Yeah, but that's before you're looking out.
It's on the ground. But, you know, listen, I had two Wounded Warriors there that had lost both of their legs, and they were so excited. So I thought to myself, you know, who am I to have any anxiety? Think what these individuals have gone through. But
sure.
Then when the plane started climbing and climbing and climbing, and the door was right to my right. It's like a garage door. It slides up, and then this whole open back of the plane, and I was right there. And that for a couple minutes. And then once you do it, everything rushes at you so fast that then you get into the moment, and you actually, in the free fall, and you got, you're like, you know, you got your arms out, and off you go. It was fun.
Would you do it again?
Oh, absolutely. I think once, Isaac, you get through the first one,
yeah.
I think, you know, you do it again. The guy who was with me, you know, trains our Navy SEALs, and I think he has done 17,000 jumps. Yeah, he wanted, probably would not have been good for anyone to have the governor go down in your state. So they gave me a well-experienced guy to go down with. But we all hit, you know, we all went tandem. But it was exciting. And then at the end, you know, we're all on the beach together, and we went over to the concert and had a couple beers and had a great time.
And your wife was okay with it?
She was okay. In fact, in fairness, Dorothy, she had another event. She was dying to do it as well. Yeah.
Well, so you can go tandem skydiving with your wife.
Yeah.
Next time.
But in order to do it alone, you've got to go through a whole, what, a six-month course, and you got to really that takes some time commitment. But it was fun. You should do it, Isaac. Everything's worth doing once.
All right. I'll tell my wife that you endorsed
it. Yeah, tell her. I recommend it.
Let's talk about Hillary Clinton a little bit. I know that, and I don't want to talk a lot about Hillary Clinton, but, you know, there's this debate going on as she has been speaking out more of whether people say she should be quiet, she should scale back. You're her friend, in addition to being someone who is obviously a close supporter. What do you make of that conversation?
You know, listen, I have spent a lot of time talking with Hillary after the election. I'm very proud of Virginia. You know, we were the only southern state, one of three or four swing states that actually went for Hillary. We were very proud of our work. I think you got to move forward. You just got to move forward. There were so many circumstances in that election, so many intervening events. You know, think how hard it is. I mean, to go through what she went through. And I think the hard part is, you know, and you've got to see Donald Trump every day and the insane things that he's doing that are so hurtful to the country and to the values that we all believe in. You know, I think that's hard on her. But, you know, my advice would be we just got to move on. Now,
but should she be talking as much as she is? Should people scale back when they're saying to her?
Well, there obviously were serious issues that need to be dealt with. I mean, the Congress is doing the right thing. I mean, this is a direct threat to the democracy of the United States. There is no question that they were trying to destabilize our government. Russia has been pretty clear, thought that Hillary would win, wanted to destabilize her presidency, and really bring questions about the greatest democracy in the world. That went on. And she is privy to a lot of the information. Obviously, she spent a time looking at it. But I think for her, there are enough people, I think, who can come out and deal with those issues. We, as a party, need to understand what happened.
Yeah.
My goodness. We can't let, you know, the next election, the same things that happened in this election, where you had active treasonous events occurring, and the idea that, you know, a foreign actor can get in and be involved in our elections, we have to stop it. So that awareness has to be raised, has to be analyzed, has to be fixed. And I think there are enough people, my advice would be to Hillary, there's enough people that will do that and get that information out. But come on, Isaac, this is so hard.
Treasonous is, you threw that word in, treason is, if you are, if you're an American, you can commit treason, but that's different, right, from Russians, right? Do you think that there are Americans who committed treason?
I think as we get into this, it seems to me that Russia was actively involved in destabilizing our democracy.
But were there American people?
Somebody, I believe, had to give them a roadmap. Recently, you saw where that memo, I think it involved Loretta Lynch and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Hillary's political director and someone who worked for George Soros, that this whole email chain about, oh, we're not going to investigate this, don't worry, was all made up by the Russians.
Yeah.
Somebody had to give these people a roadmap. These four people had never met each other.
Yeah.
So I believe somewhere in this, somebody was directing the Russians on whose names to use, what impact a certain people sending a memo would have on the American electorate. I mean, they just didn't sit over in some cubicle over there somewhere in Moscow and figure this out.
You have a theory on who that person might be?
I'll let the investigation go, but it seems to me that there was somebody, you know, and listen, it was, every day in the paper you're seeing, you know, new evidences of new contacts that weren't disclosed. Something was going on.
Yeah. I mean, clearly there at best there are a lot of coincidences here, and at worst it's beyond.
But step back for a minute. This was a direct assault on the democracy of the United States. This is as serious as it gets for our nation.
Yeah.
And I applaud the Congress. They're doing what they need to be doing. As governor, that's not my role. My role, job creation, all the things I have to do as governor, protect our state. But they're doing what they have to do. They have to protect the democracy of this great country. And clearly, Russia was involved in trying to destabilize our government. And we're not going to tolerate that with any foreign actor.
One of the things that seems to me is driving some of the people who are telling Hillary, like, it's time to not talk anymore, is people who are mad that she lost, basically. There are a lot of Democrats who seem, like, torn up by the idea that Trump is president, and they're sort of putting that on her. Now, some of it you can fairly put on her. Do you think that that's right, that some of what's going on here, some of this backlash to her speaking out is that, or is that just that's just my theory?
I think after the election, there obviously was tremendous angst. You know, a week before the election or even the day of the election, you know, everybody thought that Hillary would win, sure. We'd capture control of the United States.
I was at the Javits Center. I mean, there.
Thought we'd control the United States Senate. I remind Isaac that you folks were all writing the demise of the Republican Party and what are they going to do in a post-Trump, you know, that their party was ruined and they're going to have to rebuild.
I've since written the demise of the Democratic Party.
And now we have the shoe on the other foot. It happened very quickly. And after elections are over, you know, they're always tough times. People start finger point. But, you know, I don't spend a lot of my time. I have to move forward. I got up the next day. I'm the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I got to work. People elected me to do a job. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time, you know, navel gazing and looking back. You can't look in the rearview mirror. You got to look positively forward. People expect me to do things for them.
Yeah.
And listen, I was as upset as anybody. I mean, I put my heart and soul into it. I mean, I love this party. I've worked for it for going on 40 years now in every level of this great party. And I was sick about the election. But I still got to get out of bed every day, and 8.5 million Virginians are counting on me on job creation, protect their values. And, you know, as you know, I've vetoed 120 bills in Virginia.
It's record,
you know,
setting,
horrible,
right?
Bills, anti-women, anti-LGBT, anti-environment, pro-gun, and anti-voting rights. You know, those are value statements. I veto those because they're not in line where we are as a state and how we view about our values and the morality and how you treat people with dignity and respect and job creation and fixing education. And, you know, I'm proud last year, Isaac, we put $1 billion in education, the single largest investment, to totally redo all of our K through 12. Everybody deserves a shot. Everybody deserves a shot of making sure they can go out and get a job and provide for their family. To me, this all starts with education. It starts early on at, you know, kindergarten. I'm a huge supporter of pre-K. You know, thanks to my wife's efforts, 9 million more breakfasts will be served in Virginia this year to needy children. You know, you can't expect a child to learn. They're hungry to learn, but they can't learn when they're just plain hungry. I mean, could you imagine in many homes, and we deal with poverty issues, can you imagine you probably didn't have a dinner, you come to school, you have no breakfast, and we're expecting these children to learn STEM courses when their stomach's growling? Yeah. So these are the things that I actually focus on. I can't live back the presidential election. I can't.
I want to ask, I promise you, this is the last question about Hillary. This is it, okay? And then I have a lot of other questions.
Okay.
Why didn't you join the board of Onward Together, her group?
What is that?
Her political action group.
Oh, her new PAC?
Yeah.
I haven't put any focus into it at all. And I have my own PAC called Common Good.
I'm aware.
Yeah, so, I mean, she's got a PAC doing.
She didn't ask for that, right?
No.
No. So let's talk about Donald Trump.
What is the name of it? I didn't know the name.
Onward Together.
Terrific.
Like,
great.
Stronger Together.
Got it. Very clever. Yeah.
It's even got a very similar logo. the arrow and everything.
You know, I'm sure she wants the PAC to go out and help candidates who helped her. I mean,
it's funny that you hadn't even heard of it, though. That's great.
I mean, I knew she was starting the PAC.
Yeah, you've got your life to live and a state to run.
Don't take this the wrong way, Isaac. I'm not spending a lot of my time sitting around reading political press and what's happened and what.
You should only read Politico. That's the only Politico.
Politico is the only thing I'll read. Yeah. But, you know, listen, I'm leaving next week. I'm going on my 28th trade mission. I'm the most traveled governor in America. I mean, we've created a lot of jobs to help folks. And, I mean, I got to focus on that. I mean, I leave every night with a binder 3-4 inches thick every night of what I got to do the next day and the policy initiatives. I mean, I'm busy, as are most governors. I mean, we have states to run.
Donald Trump has been president for 5 months about now. There's been a lot of noise, been a lot of tweets, there's been a lot of speculation about what things will be. How has it practically affected the lives of Virginians, what he's been doing?
Good question. Horribly.
But in what way? Like in a real way?
Yeah. I also serve as chairman of the National Governors Association, and I had the opportunity to sit with the president at the White House at the big NGA dinner, and I made it very clear to him. I looked him face to face, 4 inches from his eyeballs, and said, everything you have done has hurt my economy. Number one, when he came in the federal hiring freeze. I mean, you look at Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, you know, the federal hiring freeze is really hurtful to our economy. It's painful to those federal workers who are here. I'm trying to get young people to come into the federal workforce. It's an aging workforce. So that hurt us. The travel ban, you know, I was one of the first elected officials. I went to Dulles Airport. I had been tipped off early in the morning, 10 o'clock or so, that, you know, we had a family there at the airport. Five Virginians, two children with passports. These folks were being detained without access to legal counsel. So I went up with my Attorney General Mark Herring in front of the cameras and said, you know, this is a disgrace. This is a disgrace to our country. This airport is in, you know, my state, Dulles Airport. And we're just not going to stand silent and allow people to be detained without access to counsel. That travel ban directly cost me two business opportunities of two companies that we had been working with.
That just said, we don't want to do it anymore.
And they weren't from the seven countries. They were Muslim, but they weren't from the seven countries. But they just said, this is just not the time to come to America. I understand that.
How much money do you think that cost the state?
Well, you know, it was tens of millions of dollars of economic activity for us. I mean, but that's just two that I happen, Isaac, to be in the middle of. I mean, probably dozens that I don't even know about today. The other thing I would say is the immigration policy has been horrendous. And I've really leaned in on this issue. I've been very vocal. You know, in Virginia, we had a situation where individuals were walking out of a church, out of a hypothermia center, accosted by ICE agents with no reason. And really is bothersome. Understand, in Northern Virginia, small business is the economic engine. Northern Virginia, 60% of the ownership of the small business are foreign-born. So I've traveled around. I've gone to the little grocery stores. And, you know, these folks are so entrepreneurial. There's a chilling effect on everybody. They don't want to invest. They don't want to build new stores. They just don't know. So this has been bothersome. I called Secretary Kelly, and I met with him privately for 45 minutes. And I said, I want to know what the policy is, because you're hurting. You're scaring the people in Virginia. And, you know, Secretary Kelly, you know, 45-year Marine, 4-star general. I have a son in the Marines. I pay attention to when a Marine. And he said, Governor, let me be clear. None of those 11.4 million people who are here illegally will be deported unless they commit a serious criminal offense. That's the policy of the U.S. government. And I said, well, General, will you allow me, when I go out and meet the press, I can state that's the policy? He said, sure. Policy of the DHS. I then happened to be at the NGA dinner with the president, and I looked him right in the eye, and I said, Mr. President, your immigration policies are hurting my business. And he goes off and, you know, well, no, we're not, da-da-da. And I said, well, here's what your secretary told me today, or yesterday, it was the next day, and made it clear. And I said, is the policy, your policy, sir, that nobody gets deported unless they commit a serious criminal offense? Yeah, that's it. You know, the next day at the big press conference, I talked to Terry at length about this issue. But the problem, Isaac, that has happened is that's not the policy that's happening on the ground. As you saw, I just pardoned a woman. She was stopped for a tail light being out. Mm-hmm. and she didn't have a driver's license, so she was driving without a driver's license. So now they're going through the deportation process. And she has two children, a husband. They live in Virginia. It's not making Virginia any safer to deport this woman. And I knew when I did the pardon that, you know, that wasn't going to stop it. I can't stop a federal law. But I thought raising the issue and helping her with the judge to say, well, this driving offense she has been pardoned for, but they still intend to deport her. You hear stories about people stopped for driving under the influence. You heard about the gentleman who had the restaurant, you know, somewhere out in the Midwest. So I'm very concerned about this. The policy that they tell me to my face is not the policy that's happening on the ground, and it's very concerning. This is not the United States of America that we know.
And that seems to be the case in larger ways, right? Secretary Kelly, General Kelly, said that it's a travel pause, like 10 days ago, that the president has been tweeting, no, it's a travel ban. It don't call it anything else. It's politically correct to call it anything else. Do you have any sense from him, from any other government officials, that we can ever get a clear bead on what the actual policy is?
Or not is it with just this man as president, Isaac. You know, I think it constantly changes, you know, with a new tweet that comes out every single day. But I just left. I just left the entire Mexican chamber. I was over at the Chamber of Commerce here. Mexican chamber, several of the governors were up. And I talked about trade policy. And, you know, I'm very big into trade. I'm an agriculture state. And the angst that they feel, you know, let's just take Mexico for a second. And in 2015, the foreign direct investment was $35.5 billion. 40% of everything that comes from Mexico to America, do you know where it's made? America. So what Trump is now doing with one of our strategic, you know, my second biggest exporter, third biggest importer, as a governor, trade to me equals jobs. And his incoherent, really disingenuous policy, and I would actually say an immoral policy of what he is doing to these nations who are our friends. I mean, just this week, to pull out of the Paris Agreement, I mean, think about this for a second, 192 countries, I mean, goodness gracious, North Korea and Iran are in the agreement. The only ones out are Syria and Nicaragua. The work and effort to get all those countries together, that genie can never be put back in the bottle. Contrary, you know, he liked to say we're going to we're not renegotiating that.
You joined the Climate Alliance, the states that are living up to the Paris Accord, essentially. Cities are doing that.
Yeah.
It's not just with climate. A lot of cities and states that are opposed to Trump are that are run by governors and mayors, I guess I should say, that are opposed to Trump, are standing against the federal government. It seems like this is like the classic Republican dream in a way that is, right? Like states are moving on their own. We're moving away from federalism.
Well, that's a good point.
Is that concern you, or is that like just the way that things are going to be here?
Well, let me say, as an American, I am concerned because, you know, I want to be the best governor I can be. But, you know, this is the United States of America. So I wish we had a national policy that we could all embrace because it betters, you know, the betterment of everybody. But, you know, I went out 2 weeks ago, even before this, and was the first state in the new Trump era to say, I'm going to do this myself. I mean, they are not going to lead on the Clean Power Plan and the Paris Agreement. So I went out through an executive directive that I did myself, an executive directive number 11, to do our own carbon dioxide emission reduction and energy insufficiency job creation. And I'm going to trade with those 13 Reggie states that are out there today. And, you know, for a state like Virginia, a southern state, that was a big deal. That was a proud moment for Virginia.
But we're moving, because you oppose what the federal government is doing, you're moving away from the federal government. And you're not the only one. I know, right? It's not just Virginia.
This is bad. Isaac, you're hitting it right on the head. This is not good for our country. But let me tell you this. I'm going to use all the unilateral executive power that I have myself to beat back Donald Trump on what I think are immoral, valueless propositions that he continues to push out. I'm going to do that. I'm going to fight him. I will use executive authority. I've been, as you know, very aggressive with executive authority. I mean, but it's a value system for me. I mean, you know, I took a lot of grief when I restored the rights of returning citizens, felons. You know, 40 states, Isaac, had made it automatic. Virginia had a horrible history. I mean, I stood and announced this where a state senator in 1902 had put a literacy tax, poll tax, and, you know, into our Constitution, disenfranchisement. And the state senator actually said, I am doing this to eliminate the darkie from being a political force in Virginia. Well, I'll tell you,
it's very subtle.
Yeah, very subtle, yeah. I mean, I was very proud that 114 years later, I got to stand there and say, a new sheriff in town, to reverse that. And as you know, the Republicans sued me twice, and I ultimately won. And I now sit here, and I'm very proud that I've restored more rights than any governor in the history of the United States of America. That's what leadership is about, moral-based, value-based. And that's what the Trump administration is lacking. I will work with the president. I will work with him on health care, on infrastructure, because I am an American. And there has been no effort from this White House to want to work with any of us on anything that would move our states or this country forward.
You talked about the stuff that you did, restoring voting rights, the climate policy. You ran against the NRA when you ran for governor in 2013. You're the first Southern governor to officiate a gay wedding.
That's right.
You can't run for reelection. You are legally barred.
Yeah.
But you are, your poll numbers are pretty good right now.
Very good, yep.
What do you say to the people who have been running away from some of those issues? What do you get that they're not getting?
Well, remember when I ran on 13, I mean, most people say I'm the most progressive governor in Virginia history. I mean, if you go through the litany of the things, and I'm proud to have done it, but no one should be surprised, Isaac. I ran on these issues. When I ran for governor in Virginia, I took on the NRA. That's something that traditionally people didn't do in Virginia. They're based in Virginia. I had an F, and I said I was proud of the F. Wish I had a lower grade, but that was the lowest they gave me. I told women I would be a brick wall to pretend their rights. I talked about abortion rights every single day. And I talked about LGBT rights.
And got elected in a Southern state.
And got elected, got our base out, ended up getting more votes than any Democrat ever got running for governor. Very proud of that. But you know what? People came out, and I was running against an attorney general who was against all of those things. But here's what happens. This is, you know, I'm trying to run a progressive state, putting progressive values out there, at the same time making sure everybody has an opportunity for a job. But you can't create jobs if you don't have a state that's open and welcoming to everybody. When I came into office, the prior administration, as you know, had passed these horrible regulations. We had the transvaginal bill, horrible bill. And then we had what they had done is these trap regulations to go in and pass this new legislation for our women's health clinics that, as you know, added a water fountain, widened a wall 5 inches, added a parking spot, had nothing to do with safety. It was all about shutting the women's health clinics down. But you know what, Isaac? I went in as governor. I got to replace the Board of Health. And my new Board of Health members overruled every one of those trap regulations. And the clinics haven't closed. That's why I tell people elections matter. Women know that I have been a brick wall, will continue to be a brick wall. I've leaned in to protect LGBT rights. First Southern governor to perform gay marriage, I think third in the history of the country. You'll be surprised at that. You know who was number one?
Hit me.
Arnold Schwarzenegger out in California. And then I believe it was Duval Patrick who did Barney Frank's wedding up in Massachusetts. So, you know, I came after that.
It's interesting company to be in.
Yeah, Schwarzenegger is a Southern governor, but it's worked. I mean, the interesting thing in Virginia, even Republicans will say today, and this is why we've been able to help move this progressive movement in Virginia, because the results on economically, when you're open and welcoming, you can create jobs. And as I say, we've taken unemployment from 5.4 all the way to 3.8. We're now the second lowest of any major state in America. Totally transformed our economy because we're open and welcoming. Look at North Carolina. Look at HB2.
Yeah.
And people will even say, McAuliffe is really, you know, clearly the most progressive governor, most progressive legislation. But it makes sense to us. What I'm proud of is that people who would never listen to me on these topics before are now open to listening to me because the metrics of the job creation, they've had to say, well, I guess he's right.
Do you think you call yourself a progressive and you've got the record to justify that? But there is this fight within the Democratic Party of, like, what's a progressive right now? And I'm not talking about rehashing 2016 anymore. I'm talking about where the party is at this moment. Is it a false fight? Is it something that Democrats need to get over? Or is there something real to this debate that you know, in the DNC race was encapsulated by Tom Perez versus Keith Ellison, which was so strange because Tom Perez is pretty far to the left, but was turned into not a progressive in a way that, to me, represents the way that this debate is not always about what your positions are exactly.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, we get in this debate on labels way too much. What I think is, and I call it more values and a moral structure than labeling anything, the values of open and welcoming, pro-women's rights, pro-gay rights, pro-environment, anti-gun, those are a value system of who I believe, you know, that's who I am. People, when they went to the polls in 2013, Isaac, there was no question where I stood on the issues. The one thing, whether you like me or you don't like me, you will always be able to say, we know where Terry McAuliffe stands. Mm-hmm. I don't sit here and poll and do all these other things.
It's the benefit of a one-term governorship, I guess.
Yeah, but I would have been, if you know my personality, I've always sort of been like this. You just lean in and do the thing. I knew when I did the restoration rights, I mean, I'm the first governor to be sued for contempt of court, taken to the Supreme Court in Virginia. But I knew that was going to happen, but that doesn't mean you don't do it. You do what your value system says is right. This is right for these people. And I got to tell you, I have people stop me no matter where I go in the country and just say thank you. I cannot tell you the people in Virginia, brother, cousin, you know, mother, father, who've had their rights restored. And remember, I'm just giving you your voting rights back. I'm not changing your sentence or gun right. I'm giving you the decent dignity to be able to go vote. Because what really...
That's the thing that you feel like has resonated the most, it feels like, of things
no
that
question.
You've done.
Yeah. No question. And this is, as I say, you know, some far extreme right Republicans in Virginia will even say, doesn't surprise me what Terry's doing. This is he's doing what he said he would do. And I just think that's important in politics. And you do what you think is right, and, you know, the chips are going to fall where they may. I haven't been successful at everything. I've worked like a dog, Isaac, to get Medicaid expansion done. They will not vote for it. My Republicans, and remember, I have a legislature, House of Delegates, that is 66 Republicans out of 100 with a very heavy Tea Party influence. I'm proud to say, though, that on economic development, they've worked with me. On education, I got the largest investment in Virginia history, $1 billion for K through 12. On fixing transport, they've worked with me. There are issues we have worked together. We obviously, as I say, 120 vetoes have the most vetoes. They don't agree with me on the social issues. But they'll even say, well, we always know where Terry stands on the issue. And all I tell people running for office, stand for what you believe in. Guess what? If you lose, you know, your life's going to go on the next day. Don't worry about it.
You lost once.
I lost, and I lost badly.
Yeah.
I remember I told them, I said, listen, I ran on a platform of big ideas, renewable energy and high-speed rail and clean energy. And I said, if you don't like my big ideas, don't vote for me. And they didn't. I got crushed. But you know what? What's the key? You get up the next day, you dust yourself off, and you get back in that arena.
Or 4 years later. Next day or 4 years later.
Yeah.
I
got up the next day. It was work for 4 years.
you talk about your record. Yeah. So let me give you, I talked to you about another theory that I have. Here's, maybe let me sketch something out. You've got a record that you have worked with Republicans on that has done you pretty well in terms of the way it's been received by Virginia voters. You are the governor of a big state. You have connections to pretty much every Democratic donor in the country. Why aren't you an obvious candidate for president in 2020?
I think most importantly, I'm focusing on what people elected me to do. I mean, I go morning to night. I literally do this morning to night. You know, I try to cram in 10, 15, 20 events a day. We have a lot of exciting. I have a jobs announcement today. I've been up here. I did a podcast already on cybersecurity. I spoke
to
the Mexican Chamber.
Day. Huh? It's a two-podcast day for you.
It's a two-podcast day. I'm excited about it. And I take my job very seriously. And I want to finish strong. I'm not going to walk through the tape. I'm going to sprint through that tape. I've got about 7 months left. I got about $5-6 billion worth of projects I got to close. I already have the all-time record. But for me, this is job. This is giving everybody a shot. And I want to finish here strong. Still have five children. Still have two. at home. So, you know, we have a very busy household in Virginia. And whatever comes next, comes next. But I take – when I took the oath of office, I mean – and to think about this, Isaac, I sit in the chair and Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry, and you know, I take this job very seriously. But what I know and what I love about being governor is you can help people every single day. You have the executive authority to literally change people's lives. And no, in all deference to my good friends who serve in Congress, I think that's terrific. It's not for me.
Right.
But as an executive...
There was that theory that maybe had Tim Kaine been elected vice president that you would have been interested in the Senate, but it doesn't seem to fit
you
at
all.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I was very public.
Right. No,
never do it.
Right.
And all due respect, Tim and Mark, I mean, I love them all. It's just not who I am. You know, I like executive authority. Yeah. I come from a business background. I like to make decisions. But the great thing about governor is let it be restoration. And the other nice thing, I've totally transformed our criminal justice system in Virginia. Our juvenile justice system, one of my proudest achievements, is the juvenile justice system. We have decreased by half the number of juveniles we've had in our facilities. When I came into office, we have two places called Beaumont and Bon Air. Visited both of them, first governor. These were maximum security prisons for 14-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, I walked out of the first one, Isaac, and I just shook my head. So I'm shutting those down, and I'm building small community-based homes where the children who are there are getting skill sets, are being taught, so that when they come out, we can have a job waiting for them. You know, and on the restoration of rights, I mean, this is the stuff I love to do.
But I'm going to bring you back to the president question. I was talking to somebody who wants to see you run, mm-hmm. who said to me, in some ways, Terry's like the bizarro Trump or the anti-Trump, and this is how it was meant, that you...
Did you say bizarro?
Bizarro, like okay. In Superman.
Okay.
Like, because you have business experience also, and you've brought some of that to the way that you govern,
yeah.
But in a way that to this person seemed... much more productive than the way that Trump has grafted his business experience onto the
yeah.
White House. And the other thing about it was that you have, you don't mince words a lot. You have a
right.
way of saying things that puts you right out there. Although the way it was put to me was that you tend to, when you over-exaggerate on something, it's like to say somebody more positive, like that you would go around when you were DNC chair and say, this congressman's the greatest congressman in the country. No matter.
I still do that today. Right. If you could have been with me, I was in five cities yesterday. I had the greatest mayor in the greatest city. You know, listen, but here's the difference to me and Trump. Trump says it about himself.
Right.
I never say it about I'm talking about other people. But, yeah, I am probably the most optimistic person you've ever met. I have, luckily, boundless energy, and I think everything is great. But, yeah, I have fun. I mean, listen, too many people are lemon suckers in politics today, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, I have been successful by motivating people. People want to be with winners, not whiners. So I've tried to motivate. I've always tried to make things fun. And be honest with you, that's how I've been able to get so many Republicans in a very Republican legislature to work with me on the core value issues that I have. Pete, you need results. For me as governor, I need results. I've got to work with whatever, you know, I'm not changing that House of Delegates. Redistricting, you and I can talk about that later. I think that's destroyed democracy in America, these gerrymandered districts. But, I mean, we had 140 of our legislative seats up. I think 82 didn't even have an opponent last time. I mean, this is the problem. And then Medicaid expansion is hard enough to try. I've had Republican legislatures in the dark of night come over and say, Governor, I would vote for this tomorrow. But if I do, I will lose my Tea Party primary. And that's what's wrong with politics today. You go to rural parts of Virginia where they've lost coal, textile furniture, and tobacco. And 400,000 Virginians would have access to health care that we've already paid for. I have forfeited, Isaac, right now $10.5 billion of our money that could have got health care 365 days a year for these 400,000. I have an opiate crisis. I have a mental health crisis. And I am forfeiting $10.5 billion because people are scared of a Tea Party primary. And this is why, rightfully, people hate politicians, because they don't think they're in it for them. They think that they're in it for themselves. People don't ask much of their elected leaders. They really don't. You know what they want, Isaac? They want a quality job. They want an education system that works for their kids. They want a transportation system that's functional. It shouldn't take them 2.5 hours to go see their kids play a ball game. And they want health care. If you can deliver those basics, most of the voters are pretty happy. And the time that they spend up in that building, that Capitol up there, debating things that do not move the ball forward, do not help one single person, there is a lack of moral leadership and values. Because we're not doing things to help people.
Is that a bipartisan thing? I mean, you're critical of the Republican president and Republican members of Congress. Have the Democrats, do they need to find their way in a way that the party doesn't right now? Is there a need for that going into 2018, going into 2020? Obviously, you've got an election on your mind for this fall.
Yeah, we've got, you know, we've got, it's a good segue into one of the main things I'm going to be doing next. I mean, we have two governors up this year, Isaac. We have 36 up next year, 38 governors between now and November. November 18. Here is the biggest concern I have is these gerrymandered. So I'm now working with Eric Holder and Nancy Pelosi and others on this national redistricting effort.
You left out Obama. You left out Obama.
Well, the three of us are traveling around the country on weekends doing it. Right. And the president's very helpful. He's all in. I haven't got him to travel with me yet, but he will. But he's all in. And Eric does a lot of the work directly with him. But because of these gerrymandered districts, I mean, look at Virginia. All five statewide are now Democrats. President Obama carried it twice, and Hillary carried the state. And last year, it was 8 Republicans and 3 Democrats. There was a lawsuit filed, and we actually were able to pick up one seat with Don McEachin. We need to be doing that everywhere around the country because it's important. But here's the issue Democrats face. You want to talk about real challenges and how I got into this. I called Nancy up the day after the last election. I said, Nancy, this party, we have a fundamental problem here. We always focus on the presidentials. We don't do anything state and local. And let me tell you why this matters. Because in 2020, they're going to redraw every line in America. 2021, these Republican chambers, they now control 35 states, Isaac, both chambers and the governor. So these Republican legislatures, vast majority in America today, are going to draw maps that will give them more seats. And the congressional map. There's one person who can stop it. A Democratic governor.
It's funny that you say it, it came to you after the election, because I wrote an article that broke the news about the group being formed, the Holder, that was then the Holder effort. And it came out about 10 days before the election, and people were interested in
it.
And
then Nancy wasn't in it till.
No, and then and then afterwards, I started getting emails from people on the internet saying, "Oh, what's this group from Democrats who were shaken by the election?" And that's when you got involved. That's when Pelosi got involved. It seems like that's the big takeaway from what happened for you. And again, we're not rehashing 2016, but
Right. Well, we at the governors, the DGA, Sherlock and I started a thing, unrigged the map.
Yes.
But now take it to the next level.
But a sense of just how deep the problem in the party was that wasn't there when you guys were thinking that the election was going
to
go
now
the other
come to light. Yeah. I mean, we in the last 8 years, we've lost 900 plus legislative seats. I mean, you know the map. But here's the issue for Democrats is we only have 16 Democratic governors in America today. They're the only ones who can veto a Republican map, and they control a vast majority of the state chambers. That's the problem that our party is in. And what people need to understand, I know we always talk about Washington. I tell people, you got to get off that. What's happening at the state? What are they doing state by state? They're rolling back voting rights. I vetoed a bill that in order to get an absentee ballot in Virginia, you would have to fax in your driver's license. Well, let me tell you something, Isaac. A lot of people don't have a driver's license, and they clearly don't have fax machines. Oh, you got to get in your car and go to Kinko's and photocopy and mail. This is what has happened systematically around the country. They use the state legislatures to pass these voting laws that make it harder for people to vote, which helps them win elections, which helps them pick up more congressional seats. And they're doing all these defunding Planned Parenthood bills. And all of this is happening at the state level, not the federal.
So do you spend next year when you're out of office and campaigning for governors in addition to the redistricting committee group?
Those two will be my big issues, the NDRC.
Traveling around the country?
All over the country. You bet. And doing these 30, next year will be 36 governor's races. But if we don't win a vast majority of these, Isaac, I'm telling you today, 2021, the new map, if they have more Republican members for 10 years, this is why this race in Virginia is so important. The next governor I mean, we have 66 Republicans out of 100. Are we going to get control back? I don't know. It's going to be hard to do it. One person, that Democratic governor, or all the things that we have been able to do, the 120 vetoes that I vetoed that were sustained, I'm 120-0. I never lost a veto. Every one of them will become law. Every single one of them with a Republican governor. On guns, women, gay rights, all of them, Isaac.
And then December 2018, January 2019, you decide what your next step is?
Yeah. Yep. Be a good father.
I'll ask you one last question. Yes, as people go into thinking about this year's races, the midterms next year, and then starting to gear up for what the presidential race will be. Democratic Party is trying to figure out what it is for, but also sort of what it's against. It's what the bad guy is the way that some people put it to me, right? It did not work in 2016 to make Donald Trump the bad guy. You have a lot of members of Congress who are talking a lot about Vladimir Putin. That is not resonating, that Putin is going to be the bad guy. There's a desire among some in the party to make Wall Street the bad guy. What do the Democrats make the bad guy? How do they orient themselves about the thing? You talked a lot about what Democrats need to be for, but what's the thing that they need to be against? Yeah.
And let me just say, I hope nobody who is listening to this podcast is giving one second thought to the presidential campaign. Because honestly, Isaac...
No, I'm talking about even going...
I just want to reiterate, what I'm facing in Virginia this year in election, and then in 2018, is the future of the Democratic Party in our country. Because no matter what happens at the presidential, and I want to win it more than oxygen itself, but it's state by state, the systematic rolling back of the values, the morals that we stand for as a party, and the issues we stand, it's being done at the state level. And we as a party, let me be very clear, we all get all gassed up around the presidential and raise billions, and then we fall off. These state elections, and this is the one thing I'm really trying to convey, these state elections, the damage that is done in state houses, forget Washington, is debilitating the people, you know, who live in the state. At the end of the day, the governors are responsible for jobs and education funding, the Medicaid. You know, we run those programs in our state.
And Republicans figured that out a long time before
Democrats
did.
I think they systematically went back, and I think the Koch brothers and others with lots of money figured out that, forget, you know, nothing's going to happen in Washington, so don't spend all this time worrying about regulations because they, you know, they can't find the closet. What we smartly figured out is we can do this state by state.
So who's the bad guy?
You know, the bad guy is the policies of what we see happening today in America, the rolling back of the climate change. And the reason why I'm so passionate on climate change is I say, you know, we're the second most resilient area in America. Largest naval base in the world, Isaac, is in Hampton Roads, Virginia. Trillions of economic activity through the years. You know, every aircraft carrier in the history of our great Navy built Newport News Shipyard. So this is real. I mean, as I say, you go to Hampton Roads when it rains. Tangier Island's already a third gone. They say in the next 20 years it'll totally be gone. I mean, this goes back to 15. So this the bad guy or bad policies are those individuals who are promoting policies that are hurting, and I will say this, hurting our children. I have 5 children, and I speak for every parent out there today. I don't like anything that Donald Trump has done as it relates to immigration policy, the travel policy, anything he has done on climate change. It is very disconcerting. He has also done nothing to help our economy in Virginia. He has only hurt it. I worry about what he's doing overseas. I worry about what he does with our military. As a proud father of a first lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps, this bothers me. And I speak for every parent that has a child in military uniform today in some hot spot on the globe wondering what is this president going to do next. It's disconcerting. And that's the things I worry. That's the things that keep me awake at night.
You had your quick run-in with him at that dinner. Do you think you'll ever have another conversation with him, given how he received your initial comments?
No, I think that was probably the last I had. You know, there was a entity called the Council of Governors, which is part of the NGA that the president appoints 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans to deal with national security issues, and they just did the reappointments. Guess who didn't get reappointed?
You didn't make the cut.
I didn't make the cut. That's all right.
All right, Terry McAuliffe, thanks for taking the time. That was Terry McAuliffe. Remember again to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you're listening to. Thanks again, as always, to Bridget Mulcahy, our producer. Coming up soon, conversation with Jason Kander and more.